The church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The name is synonymous with children's books in a lot of ways. Laura Ingalls Wilder. If you know the books from which that, was it the mid-70s, late-70s TV series was drawn, where a picture of in our mind of this little house sitting on the prairie, real story of a real person's life, her family's life, as they are out there in the unsettled territories, what was then the west of the United States, a real-life story. Now, real life can be messy, it can be dirty, and you kind of get your hands dirty with real life. But if you are part of the Association for Library Services to Children, they have a way of cleaning all that up. Just take Laura Ingalls Wilder's name off of an award that had previously borne her name because, well, she was a racist. They will say just a person of her times, but nonetheless outdated and racist. We're going to be talking more about that story during the next few minutes. Joy Pullman joins us. Joy is a regular guest here on the program, managing editor of The Federalist and author of the book, The Education Invasion, a recent column for The Federalist titled, It's Not Laura Ingalls Wilder Who Is Prejudiced, It's the Librarian Smearing Her Legacy. Joy, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thank you.
Do the good folks at the Association for Library Services to Children appear to have carefully read Laura Ingalls Wilder's works?
Well, this is a really surprising truth, but it appears not to me. When I heard about, you know, the recent controversy, and I know that was on this program because I listened to you too, you talked about it, you know, with Holly Shear, how the American Library Association had demoted Laura Ingalls Wilder from one of their prizes. I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I remember all these encounters between Laura and her family, you know, because I've read all the books, I've read them to my children, you know, multiple times. So I decided to go back and reread them to kind of, you know, wow, I really need to check this out. If she's this horrible person, I don't remember that being the case. So I did that over the weekend, and what I really found was it was the exact opposite of what the message was that we were hearing from these librarians. Every time I read about her encounters with Indians or, you know, other settlers talking about Indians, the picture that Laura gives in her books is actually incredibly, I think, charitable and fair. So, for example, I mean, we know that the conditions of the time were very fraught between settlers and Indians. You know, both sides were scared of each other. Both sides hurt each other. It was very common, you know, for there to be massacres. And it is true, you know, anyway. So these were two groups that had animosity toward each other. But regardless of that, Laura's father takes them to visit Indians. When they come into their house, there's a couple of times she records, you know, they come in and they threaten her mother and the children and they steal their things. But there's other times where the family gives them a meal, you know, where they have friendly interactions. They go out to visit an Indian camp, and they're excited to head out to Indian territory. And then, you know, there's an incident where another settler whose family and friends had been murdered in one of the worst massacres in American history, she expresses the idea, you know, the only good Indian is a dead Indian, which, strong statement. I don't think it's a good statement. You know, but in the context of she's basically a trauma survivor of a horrible tragedy. And then later on in the book, Laura comments her father, I mean, this is almost an exact quote from the book. Laura says, you know, Pa did not think that the only good Indian was a dead Indian. So it's, I mean, I see over and over the Ingalls family, you know, despite reasons they would have, you know, to have a prejudiced view, to be scared of Indians. I mean, they were personally robbed and threatened by them many times. Instead, you know, of turning into prejudice and being afraid of them and overreacting, we actually see them, you know, treating them individually on a case-by-case basis and not, you know, letting the bad actions of some color their opinions about all of the people that are in this group. So I think that's actually an anti-racist message, an anti-prejudice message, and something that really allows for good discussions and good examples, you know, for all of us. You know, we have the same problems today, and that is a good lesson, you know, for us all to be thinking about when we consider our interactions with other folks.
The crazy thing about this, and you make note of it as well, Joy, is that what Laura Ingalls Wilder is doing is simply recollecting real events from her childhood. She's just telling us a story of what actually happened. Mm-hmm. It's not as though she's crafting a story in order to make Indians look bad or to further in any kind of misconception she had about them. She's just relaying what actually occurred.
Well, in her own experience, I mean, so I looked into, I wanted to learn more about this massacre that Mrs. Scott mentions, where she says, you know, that strong statement that I referred to earlier. Like I mentioned, I found out it was one of the worst massacres in American history, and the facts are really overwhelmingly on, you know, show that, you know, the settlers were murdered in their beds, men, women, and children indiscriminately slaughtered. It was, you know, if an equivalent number of people were killed today, it would be 15,000 killed. It was a horrible event that would traumatize any number of people, and these are real things that happen, and it is part of the historical record. I mean, we all know about the Trail of Tears. You know, we all know that Americans broke their treaties with the Indians. You know, so there, we all, you know, there's plenty of blame to point at both sides. But as you point out, Laura is just, you know, she mostly records the facts. You know, she says this is how this lady felt about this horrible thing that happened to her family. You know, and she says this is the Indians came in. You know, they, you know, pointed at Ma and they, you know, rifled through all of their stuff and they walked out with all their tobacco and they're all their seed. You know, they're a seed for the next spring. You know, she is merely telling us the truth of what happened. And the truth is, you know, that there isn't really a political point, I don't think, that you can make. And that's really what the American Library Association tried to turn this into, kind of an identity politics thing. But I don't think their lens of that really fits what actually happened. You know, what we see is true about history is that people on both sides did good and bad things. You know, Laura records, for example, of an Indian preventing a bunch of Indians. He argued with them for nights on end to, you know, trying to convince them not to rise up and massacre the settlers for taking away their land. So there's examples on both sides of good and bad, and that's really true to history, rather than just saying, you know, oh, you know, Laura Ingalls Wilder is a bad person because she tells the truth about, you know, the fact that it's not, we can't just impose, you know, identity politics on the past.
Had this been fiction, I still wouldn't think it's a good idea, because it would, you know, you don't even want to silence the fiction. But had it been fiction, I could kind of understand maybe a point that these are contrived events that may not paint Native Americans in the best light or something like that. My goodness. If anyone's read the Lonesome Dove series of novels, that's more adult male oriented. But for heaven's sakes, those things have got to have been on the chopping block years ago for the way they've depicted. And they are fiction, compelling fiction, but it just strikes me there's really nothing safe if the Little House on the Prairie is considered taboo for our children's consumption.
Well, and in fact, the truth is that, you know, Laura Ingalls Wilder did sanitize, you know, the history for, because she was writing for children, and, you know, of course, historians, since she's so popular, historians have gone back and looked and compared her stories to the historical record, and she left a lot, particularly of bad things, out. You know, so one of her siblings died in infancy. That's not in the books. You know, the family, you know, faced diseases that she doesn't record in the books, so on and so forth. So, I mean, so her books are not, you know, strictly accurate pieces, you know, of historical writing. But the things that she, for example, folks who know the character Nellie Olson, she said she combined a number of people into that character and gave her a new name. So her works are fictionalized and they are sanitized for children. which I actually think makes it all the more remarkable that, you know, at the time that she was writing, this is 150 years ago, you know, that her family is out there, you know. And nowadays we would think, oh, people back then are obviously prejudiced and they're a bunch of racists. This is right after the Civil War, you know. And of course, it was a time where people did, very many of them had different attitudes. But she was an extremely enlightened person for her time. And I actually wonder if that's related to her family's deep Christianity. Because as you know, Todd, Christianity, you know, tells us that we, you know, God made all people, regardless of what they look like. He loves them. He sent his son to die for them. And so I wonder if that, you know, had some influence on the way that she wrote in a way that was able to be charitable to people and set aside kind of our broken human nature that often lends us towards prejudice.
What do you make of the statement that was made by the library and organization that decided to withdraw her name from the award, that these were dated or stereotypical attitudes?
Yeah, it's actually, it's kind of confusing, and it, I think it discredits, you know, them as an organization, quite honestly, because, I'm, you know, a mom who likes to read to my kids and has read, you know, a popular thing, and if I can go back to the original source of this material and easily find that the truth repudiates this kind of message that they're putting out, this, and it's a smear, you know, to say that somebody is prejudiced or racist, that is a terrible thing to say about them, you know, and if it is true, it brings with it a lot of just social, you know, disapproval. But that means if it is not true, to apply that label to someone really is a horrible thing. It is hurting their reputation. You know, it's lying about them. It's maligning their character. So, I mean, this organization, they ought to be very careful to be faithful to the original text. You know, for heaven's sakes, they're librarians. They should know about the books that they're talking about and recommending to people and selecting for use in their libraries. So their willingness to do that to this woman, I think, speaks badly of them. And it should be something that people understand when they think about, you know, what libraries and librarians are being taught and are starting to select for their kids to be, you know, reading. Maybe it's something that parents should pay more attention to and be careful to look into, because this leading organization among librarians is willing to use its platform to defame somebody.
Finally, with about a minute here, Joy, what are your concerns educationally? Because you can hardly educate people on the past if you are, in effect, covering up what really happened in the past for the sake of protecting children today from alleged racism of the past.
Right. That is something that I, you know, it was surprising to me to see this happen. And I think, I mean, I already know, you know, based on, you know, for example, polls of university professors and teachers, that they are overwhelmingly, you know, out of step with America. They're largely progressive politically as well as religiously and so forth. And so that's, I have gotten a lot of emails and contacts from after my article from folks in the publishing and library industry, and they say, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. So it's a sad thing, but it's something that I think if parents are informed of the fact that this is the case, that can help them make better decisions about helping direct their kids towards quality content and being careful not just to take, you know, kind of a stamp of official approval at face value.
Joy Pullman is managing editor of The Federalist. She's author of the book The Education Invasion and a recent column for The Federalist titled It's Not Laura Ingalls Wilder Who Is Prejudiced, It's the Librarian Smearing Her Legacy. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Joy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On the other side of the break, we're going to continue our series introducing the books of the Bible. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will join us. We're going to go into a book that is a bunch of little pieces. There is an outline. There are relationships between the Psalms in this part of the book or the Psalms in that part of the book. We'll be looking at the Psalms with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller right after this.
For 28 years, I had the privilege of serving as a chaplain in the United States Navy.
Dr. Dan Gard, retired Rear Admiral and President of Concordia University Chicago, on the need for military chaplains.
During that time, I was able to bring word and sacrament to so many young people and their families, our sons and daughters spread throughout the world. Truly a privilege and an honor, and today, there are other chaplains that must follow. We need more LCMS chaplains in all branches of the military. It's an incredible, amazing mission opportunities to go to places no other pastor can go, but to go with the same tools that any other pastor brings wherever he goes, word and sacrament.
You can find out more about the vocation of military chaplain at lcms.org/armedforces. The LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Hi, I'm Pastor Palmer from Catalina Lutheran Church in sunny Tucson, Arizona. We're a confessional, liturgical, hymn-singing, Bible-teaching, gospel-preaching congregation, and we would love to share God's good gifts of word and sacrament with you. Look us up online at catalinalutheran.org or give us a call at 520-825-9255. God be with you.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.